listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 19th installment in an ongoing conversation that we've been having with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the Soviet Union, beginning with the Russian Revolution in 1917 and running up to the dissolution of the USSR in December of 1991. Luciana, good to see you.
Good morning, Don. Good to be here.
So I guess we're picking up with Trotsky and the role of Trotsky's ideology and his followers and that trend in the Spanish Civil War.
Yes, and well, I start with the end of the Spanish Civil War in 1939. Trotsky wrote an assessment, and I'm just going to quote him. So he wrote, "The inspirer of deceit and of the massacre of the revolutionary workers of Spain was Stalin. The defeat of the Spanish Revolution falls as a new indelible blot upon the already bespattered Kremlin gang." So that was his assessment. That Stalin crushed.
Yeah, meanwhile, Stalin is the only one that provided material assistance of any substance to the Spanish government, to the Republicans, and those who were following Trotsky decided that they could afford to cut off part of the United Front that was assembled in favor of having their revolution in the middle of an attack by the fascists. But it was Stalin's fault.
Well, Trotsky plays with words. He insists on calling this he insists on calling the Republic the Spanish Revolution. Instead of using the word the Republic, he uses the Spanish Revolution. Right. but let me let's clear that up in a minute. So I think it's important to refer to the role that Trotsky, and particularly Trotsky's writings, played in the Spanish Civil War. They left a legacy. excuse me. The Spanish Civil War and the defeat of the Republic of Republican Spain provided Trotsky with the opportunity, excuse me, to denounce the Soviet Union's policy of socialism in one country.
Right.
And he denounced it with one special word, Stalinist, a word of his own coinage.
Right.
And this slur is still used today by left liberals and Trotskyists to silence any attempt at objective evaluation of the Stalin government. So in his writings about the Spanish Civil War, Trotsky accused Stalin of strangling the workers in the Soviet Union and its worker state. That was an opportunity to say that, and of doing the same in Spain. He characterized Stalin in his writings in the Spanish Civil War as counter-revolutionary, defending capitalism in Spain, aiding the bourgeois republic, crushing the workers' revolution, both in Spain and in Russia. That is, he felt that the time was ripe for a revolution in Spain, and that this was crushed by the Republic with the aid of the Soviet Union.
Mm.
So by 1939, Trotsky was writing that Stalin had been Franco's best ally.
Yeah.
That his provincial, that Stalin's provincial slow mind had not understood that only a socialist Bolshevik-style revolution could defeat fascism.
Mm-hmm.
This is so bizarre, because that, of course, became true for the Soviet Union, but Spain did not have in place a Bolshevik revolution and a Soviet Republic of Spain.
Yeah.
So his emphasis was to say that within this civil war you had to, the potential for revolution existed, and Spain had just a short little time to effect it, and so then must crush the Republic, and then it could win it could win over fascism.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, you know, first of all, for him to be saying that about the key role that the Bolsheviks would have to play in Spain, given his own personal relationship to the bulk of the leadership of the Bolsheviks and his characterization of what happened in 1917, and, of course, his outright opposition to the foreign policy of the Bolshevik state, if you were going to use the term, around the world at this very time. So, you know, he has on the ground, not he personally, but his trend, you know, those following his ideals, PUM, of course, are probably the group that the single cause of the defeat, if there was a possibility that the Republic was going to stand. You know, they were the ones that broke up the group that had been arrayed and aligned against the fascists. And so,
absolutely. Yeah. Yes. And, you know, that was his task from the beginning, that is to split the Popular Front.
Right.
He was opposed to the Popular, opposed. He you know, wanted to destroy the Popular Front. So, but it's just so mind-boggling, because he says that you need a Bolshevik style revolution to defeat fascism, but in view of the Soviet defeat of Hitler and fascism in 1945, which of course Trotsky did not live to see, one would think that the Trotsky's views would have been dismissed by posterity. as the ravings of a profoundly bitter man whose treasonous activities in exile in Mexico against the Soviet Union were being exposed in the Moscow trials of 1937-30. I mean, at the same time that he was saying all these things against the Soviet Union, that it was counter-revolutionary and by implication should have been overthrown, well, that was actually a plot that was being exposed in the Moscow trial,
right.
A topic that we may take up, you know, again.
Yeah, we will, for sure.
I mean, later on.
Yeah.
So Trotsky's role in the Soviet, in the Spanish Civil War is interesting because the Anglophone left became enamored of Trotsky, especially after 1956.
Yeah.
When Khrushchev accused Stalin of all sorts of paranoid plots, of omnipotent despotism, of stupidity, cowardice, lack of defense preparation against Hitler's invasion. This was all in Khrushchev 1956 secret report to the party.
Right.
The cult of Trotsky, this is, you know, what I think, the cult of Trotsky, which found expression in the new left's anti-Soviet communism in the 60s among the Western left, especially the intellectual left, I found nothing but astounding.
Yep. Yeah, but I mean, perhaps, you had... Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is, in essence, you saw the final takedown of the Soviet Union being... I don't know, articulated more or less as a fight against Stalinism. You know, they had Brzezinski as a representative of the old order of Stalinism, of, you know, the archaic and the ossified and the brutal and the anti-democratic and, you know, the cult of personality, all these things that were, you know, attributed to Stalin and to Stalinism that, as a philosophy. This was, you know, when they were talking about perestroika, they were talking about restructuring, you know, out of a Stalinist mode. And, you know, the country lasted about, 8 minutes after they finally implemented the policy. And this is what Khrushchev was starting, you know, towards that trend also.
Yeah. Eventually the Western press called the resistance to the Yeltsin takeover, the resistance to that, they called reactionary communists.
Right.
Yeah.
This is the New York Times description, for example. and looking at their writings in the mid-late 30s about Germany and the Soviet Union, it's interesting that they would dare to, you know, use terminology like that ever, even if it is 70, 80 years later. But of course they did.
Yeah. So it's important to go over what Trotsky wrote in the years 1936 and 39 about the Spanish Civil War, because it is a good exercise in illustrating just how noxious his anti-Stalinist stance and campaign was, and how exalted and impractical his idea of revolution were. So that's what I want to illustrate. And I also think that it's important to go over this, what he wrote, what he stood for. If we are to learn from the victory of the counter-revolution in the Soviet Union and the overthrow of communism there, and to pick ourselves up from there and revive a socialist movement.
No.
Trotsky is just not the prophet to go to.
Right.
I mean, in condemning the Soviet Union, he condemned the first experiment in history to try the path of communism. To say that the Soviet Union was anti-communist is to reject communism altogether.
That's right.
With all its flaws or whatever, you know. So to be anti-Stalinist today, in the manner of Trotsky, is to be anti-communist.
That's right.
Now, you know, what do you say?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, in essence, you've had one successful, what followed was China and those revolutions that have taken place elsewhere, such as in Cuba and in Vietnam and other places, Korea, some others. But you had this huge block that followed from the revolution in 1917 and the the Trotskyists, really, now, but certainly, you had mentioned before that the anti-Soviet left had adopted these various Trotskyist positions and the terminology. But that terminology also prevails, particularly, the appellation of Stalinist, prevails among the anti-socialist, anti-communist, anti-progressive, and anti-democratic, even, forces, around the planet. I mean, they use Stalinism as an insult in Langley, in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere, and have for, for decades. So,
yeah, it was a gift.
Right.
I mean, Stalinism is a contribution to Cold War propaganda.
Right. It's a foundational to it and invented by Trotsky. So, so you have that. But you also have, what followed from the Russian Revolution was the USSR, and which defeated Germany. And then in the aftermath, all of the socialist states in Eastern Europe. Now, you have to look at this in the context of the wars, both World War One and World War Two, from Russia's perspective, that, we got to stop Germany from just rolling in whenever they feel like it. And so the need for and the negotiated, agreement for these countries, Poland and eastward, as buffer states, that was a part of the settlement. And rather than occupying them and raiding them, like, say, for example, the way the U.S. is handling Iraq, what they did was they helped them develop their economies. They integrated it into a socialist economic bloc, and they rebuilt it, even though they were frozen out of the rest of the world economy by the U.S. and its allies. The people there lived well. They had jobs, free education, free health care, no homelessness or any of that, all the problems that we have here.
Full employment.
Yep, yeah, all of that. And so, it wasn't the classic case of, of conquest. Now, where there were, bourgeois and or nationalist-inspired, acts of resistance to this arrangement, then the USSR was dealing with it in essence as a, look, we're not letting Germany come in here, and we know what'll happen if we let you guys do this thing or that thing or that thing. Germany will be coming in here soon. And as a matter of fact, what happened was Gorbachev allowed, in a democratic fashion, the self-determination of the East European states in 1989, and by 1995, you had the U.S. blowing up Yugoslavia and incorporating all of the former Warsaw Pact countries into NATO and deploying military up to the border, where now they drill, pretty regularly, practicing an invasion of the U.S. of this Russia.
Yeah.
So, that's what was going on. This is what Trotsky found offensive, and it coincided with what they found offensive in Langley and the Pentagon.
Apparently, yes. I mean, not just apparently, substantially.
Yeah, that's correct.
sorry. So, Trotsky in the Spanish Civil War, so as early as April 1936, after the Popular Front won election, he said that the Popular Front curbs social revolution, he wrote. The role that the Popular Front plays in the face of the powerful movement of workers' and peasants' revolution is the role of a gigantic brake built and set in motion by traitors and servile scum. So what do we see there? He assumes, and there was a powerful movement of workers and peasants, but they had not effected a revolution. All right. that was there was this bourgeois republic, which was attacked by Franco's fascism. So even before the Civil War broke out in July 1936, Trotsky advocated on April 12, 1936, a virtual revolt against the Popular Front. He wrote that the Spanish partisans of his Fourth International, now, and I don't know what the number was, but he wrote that the Spanish partisans of his Fourth International should condemn and denounce mercilessly before the masses the policy of all the leaders who took part in the Popular Front, and also to condemn the leaders of the PUM, the Poder Obrero de Unificación Marxista, that is the workers' power, the workers' power, unified power, Marxist power. Especially, he says, former left communists like Andres Nin. So what is he doing here? These people, these revolutionary people, which he assumed to exist en masse, were to overthrow the republic, to renounce the Marxist PUM, and so, in other words, to reject everyone on the Republican side and to invent on the spot another reality, in my view, to invent another people, as Brecht might say. If these people don't work for the revolution, you know, if this reality it doesn't work for the revolution, then let's invent another one.
Right.
This is, you know, delusional, but yeah. So what could these ideal masses of revolutionary people, on whose front should they be fighting on? What could they choose? So he says that Trotsky's Fourth International, its adherents should join the Socialist Party and the youth groups and create, listen to this, a fraction in the spirit of Bolshevism. To create nuclei and fractions in the trade unions and other mass organization. So, in other words, he was recommending split, and then he wrote, just to cause chaos, to intervene whoever these Fourth International adherents were, whom he disassociated from the PUM, and he wrote to direct their main attention to the spontaneous and semi-spontaneous movements, to concern themselves with the temperature of the masses and not the parliamentary cliques, to insist always on the masses forming their committees of action, elected ad hoc, juntas, Soviets, and to enlarge them constantly. Now, how are you supposed to interpret direct their main attention? How are you supposed to measure the temperature? How are you supposed to form committees of action in the middle of this fascist assault?
Yeah, I mean, here's the soil. I mean, you laid it out. Here's some numbers. In the elections in 1936, you had the popular vote on the 16th of February and the 4th of March, a couple of weeks apart.
Yes, that's right.
So you had Popular Front had 4.451 million votes, as against the National Bloc, which had 4.375. Again, 4.451 to 4.375. That's how close. Now, inside the Popular Front, you had the actual Popular Front, and then you had the Left Front, which is from Catalonia, which, by the way, it's the same party that's the primary motivator behind Catalonia's secession now. Okay,
They want a class state.
Right.
Go ahead.
So this is you had inside the 4.41 million, the Popular Front had 3.751 million, and the Left Front 700,000. So the huge bulk of it was in the Popular Front, and this imaginary left that would have been leading the revolution from Barcelona, by the way, which is where that group was kind of centered, less than a million. So out of a total vote of 9.5 million. And you know, I mean, there's so many historical ironies because, you know, sometimes the Trotskyists refer to, and just like the Wall Street Journal, for example, refer to the October Revolution as being, you know, a coup, you know, as being, you know, this small minority, you know, the vanguard, all that, you know, et cetera, being anti-democratic and, you know, per se. And yet here in Spain, let's have 700,000 people lead, you know, 9.5 million, but they have the right ideology. This is what Trotsky is selling in the midst of a war where the society is almost evenly developed, divided. Again, we've got 4.451 million on the left front, which is essentially the constitutional order with leftists in supporting it, and 4.375 million right-wing groups from center-right to the fascists being led by the fascists and attacking the constitutional order. That's how evenly divided. 4.5 million against 4.5 million, just about. And he's saying, let's split up our side.
Yes, let's split up our side. And he says more. He says, not only, you know, what you just pointed out, split the side everywhere, infiltrate the trade unions, etc. Not only that, what the Republic should have done was purge the army of its officer caste immediately.
Mm. Yeah.
And now this is particularly ironic.
Yeah, this is what they accused Stalin of doing and almost losing to Hitler, that when Stalin did that was evidence that he didn't know what he was doing, and almost, you know, basically all the people Hitler killed, it was because Stalin purged the officer class.
Yeah, and that, of course, you know, exactly. And this is particularly ironic since his followers, as you pointed out, to this day accuse Stalin of having purged the Red Army and caused the collapse of the Red Army before the Nazi invasion. And this is, you know, an oversimplification and a distortion of the real facts.
Yep.
Because the purge of the army was not huge. It was a very small element, as I think next time we can talk about the myths.
Yeah.
These myths that the Trotskys have inherited.
Mm.
But it seems that army purges by Trotskys are okay, while purges by Stalin, right, small and necessary as they were, are not.
Right.
So,
well, of course, the proof is in the pudding, of course, because at the end of the day, Stalin was right, because the USSR won. They beat Hitler. And Franco ruled Spain until the 1970s.
Yeah. Well, Stalin won because, among many other things, his generals and the Bolshevik Revolution being in place for 20 years, the industrialization.
Right.
But he also won because these Moscow trials,
right,
the trial to Kaczewski, all of these, you know, eliminated what happened in Spain, eliminated this factionalism, this splitting, this, you know, all the mess.
Yep.
You know, there's a difference between the Soviet Union and Spain. The Soviet Union had and matured a Bolshevik revolution, and Spain had not.
That's right.
And what needed to be defended was whatever was opposed to fascism. Then perhaps you could have this damn revolution that's in his obsessive mind.
Right. First you have to defeat the fascists who are at the gate.
And he says the exact opposite.
Right.
In order to defeat fascism, you have to overthrow the bourgeois state.
You know, I'd like to know if he had any experience in the schoolyard, like on the playground with you know, people fighting and how you don't get beat up being a small loudmouth like most of us guys that are involved in this stuff tend to be, how you survive that, because strategy and, you know, tactical skill, very important survival skills on a school playground. And it seems to me that he is completely and totally naive about how things actually work. Unless, of course, as I suspect, he's misrepresenting these things for people that are, in fact, naive. But, you know, there's just one last thing I want to touch on because we're almost out of time. And that is the similarities between what happened in Spain and what we've seen in particular in the last few years in Venezuela, Argentina, Brazil, you know, some other places where you have the forces on the ground, the electorate, let's say, as one manifestation of that, being pretty evenly divided. You had in each case for a good long while center-left or progressive governments, Socialist Party actually in power in Venezuela, but in Brazil and Argentina. And as you know, you have a very slow but substantive progress going on in all of these places and a massive attack by the U.S. and the West against this progress and the whole integration project in Latin America. People who are ostensibly on the left making the same statements, you know, in Venezuela, that Maduro isn't going fast enough and that's the problem, that people need to not support Maduro, who is no Hugo Chavez. Of course, they said the same thing about him. And also, so what happened was that, you know, people sat on their hands for the National Assembly election back in 2015. The same thing happened in Argentina, where some of the, you know, hard left, quote unquote, what we're saying that, you know, Cristina Fernandez de Silva and others were just not, you know, moving fast enough and that the left should stay home. And so you end up getting Macri, and they were saying the same thing about Dilma Rousseff and not standing up for her. And now you have, you know, what you have going on there. So I guess maybe we're going to have to pick this up back in Spain next week. But I wanted to point that little similarity.
You just pointed out that the reverse happens, that when you do crush the whatever exists, you know, the bourgeois, then you know, the fascists win. It's the opposite.
That's right. So we'll pick this up next week. Luciana, thank you very much. Pleasure as always.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Up next, a press conference that was held at the Washington Foreign Press Center with State Department spokesperson Heather Neward.
Hi, everyone. How are you today? It's nice to see you, and thank you so much for having me over here again. Always look forward to our chats together. Couple of things I'd like to start out with today, a few announcements of sorts. First off is I want to talk a little bit about the elections that took place in Honduras. The people of Honduras exercised their democratic rights by taking part in elections on Sunday, November the 26th. The United States looks forward to working with the democratically elected leaders of Honduras. We await the final tabulation of results by election authorities and urge the authorities to complete their work without undue delay. The United States urges calm and patience as the results are tabulated. It's critical that Honduran election authorities be able to work in a free and transparent manner without interference. We urge all candidates to respect the results once those results are announced. The United States commends the efforts of the independent election observers from the Organization of American States and the European Union and awaits their final assessment of the Honduran electoral process. Secondly, you may have heard last evening there was a verdict in the case of Ahmed Abu Qatala in the trial of the terrorist attacks in Benghazi, Libya. This is something that is important to our colleagues, in particular at the State Department, since we lost four lives that evening. We would like to express our continued gratitude to the U.S. military, to law enforcement and intelligence community for their relentless efforts to bring to justice the perpetrators of the tragic September 11, 2012 terror attacks on U.S. diplomatic facilities in Benghazi, Libya. We continue to mourn the loss of Ambassador Chris Stevens, Glenn Doherty, Sean Smith, and Tyrone Woods. The arrest and prosecution execution of Ahmed Abu Qatala were critical steps to ensure that justice is served for those dedicated Americans and public servants. Each sacrificed their lives for promoting American ideals abroad. Their State Department colleagues serving around the world today continue that important work in the same spirit and in their honor. And finally, I know something that a lot of people are watching so carefully today, and that is what happened yesterday from North Korea. As you know, the early afternoon hours on November 28th, North Korea flight tested a ballistic missile from a location north of Pyongyang. The missile flew 700 kilometers downrange before it splashed down in the Sea of Japan. The United States strongly condemns North Korea's launch of a likely intercontinental ballistic missile into the Sea of Japan, indiscriminately threatening its neighbors, the region, and global peace and security. The DPRK's relentless and lawful pursuit, unlawful pursuit, of nuclear weapons and the means to deliver them must be reversed. Together with the international community, we must send a unified message to North Korea that it must abandon its weapons of mass destruction programs. All nations must take maximum economic and diplomatic measures to increase pressure on the North Korean regime. As Secretary Tillerson has said, diplomatic options remain viable and open. The United States remains committed to finding a peaceful path to denuclearization and to ending the belligerent actions by North Korea. Our goal for the pressure campaign, in which the entire world has now joined us, is to persuade the regime it needs to reconsider the path it is currently on and think about engaging in a meaningful dialogue about a different future. The president spoke today to the South Korean President Moon and also to Japanese Prime Minister Abe, and today called the Chinese President Xi this morning. In addition to those calls, the Secretary Tillerson, spoke with Foreign Minister Kang, Japanese Foreign Minister Kono, and Canadian Foreign Minister Freeland to discuss how the global community can counter North Korea's threat to international peace. Additionally, at the invitation of Japan, Secretary Tillerson will attend the UN Security Council meeting, which is likely to take place on December 15th for the Security Council to discuss the matter of North Korea. And with that, I'd be happy to take your questions. And Benjamin's going to help facilitate since I don't know all of you.
So. All right, and a quick reminder of our rules of operation. We have two microphones out on the floor. When you get the microphone, please identify yourself by name and outlet, and please limit yourself to one question. Why don't we start with DPRK?
And if I may just add, let's try to group the countries, nations, and issues together. So, well, let's cover DPRK first. And, sir, yes. If you wouldn't mind telling me your name and your news organization.
Yes. My name is Kyu Sak-chang from Christian Broadcasting System.
Okay, great. Nice to have you here.
Yeah, about the DPRK, yeah. And Mr. President said yesterday that nothing has changed. I think that means you are going to continue the maximum pressure campaign against North Korea.
Yeah.
But yesterday, North Korea argued that they have completed their nuke power. And so do you think they have passed the red line, or can it be a game changer that you may have changed the approach to North Korea? Also, yeah, how do you assess their argument?
Okay. Let me start with the first part, our current assessment of the situation and what we plan to do. At the State Department, our approach is diplomacy. Obviously, what happened yesterday is of great concern, not just to the United States, but the entire world. We have seen two successful UN Security Council resolutions that were unanimously passed late summer and over the fall, including Russia and China as members of that. We have put together our maximum pressure campaign, which many nations have taken part in. That campaign consists of the United States and many other nations issuing sanctions. In addition to that, we have asked not just the United States, but these other countries to shrink the size of the North Korean footprint in many other countries. In addition to that, we've asked other nations to kick out North Korean guest workers, simply because those North Korean guest workers are essentially working as slave laborers. They don't get to keep the money that they make. Much of that money goes back to North Korea, and we recognize that that money, as it doesn't go home to their families, we see the conditions of the people, we see the humanitarian rights issues in North Korea. Their people are starving. You've heard about the tapeworms and things like that in people's bodies and the malnutrition. That money, instead of going to the people, goes to the nuclear and ballistic missile weapons programs. Part of our maximum pressure campaign is to choke off that money supply that goes into the North Korean regime. We have seen more than 20 countries around the world jump on board that maximum pressure campaign and start to take place with those activities, shrinking the North Korean guest workers, kicking out ambassadors, those types of things. We regard that campaign as being successful. But the entire world acknowledges that this is not something that will necessarily change overnight. That campaign is a long effort, and we will continue to push ahead with that. Obviously, this new development is something that's very serious. The secretary, as well as the president, got on the phone yesterday and made a series of calls about what is next. Many of you know what is happening later today, UN Security Council meeting that will take place. I can't comment too much on that meeting because I will leave that to my colleagues at the United Nations, at the U.S. UN office there to handle much of that. In addition to that, the secretary spoke yesterday about additional measures that could enhance maritime security. Some of this information is just being pulled together at this time, but it would essentially include the right to interdict transporting goods to and from North Korea. That could be a major new pressure point that could help in this overall campaign. In addition to this, the United States, in partnership with Canada, will convene a meeting of the United Nations Command Sending States. It would also include the Republic of Korea and also Japan. Those are things that the secretary brought up with his counterparts yesterday. We are looking to expand our diplomatic campaign to try to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. That is something that we are committed to as this administration as a top national security issue.
Still on North Korea?
Sorry, that was a little long.
North Korea?
Yes. Okay. Hi.
Thank you. My name is Carsten von Namen. I work for Deutsche Welle, German international public service broadcaster. My question concerns the issue of ambassadors you just mentioned in North Korea. One of the countries that do have an ambassador there is Germany, a close ally of the U.S. Would you also want Germany to recall the ambassador or end diplomatic relations, or is that maybe an important channel of communication also for the U.S.?
That's a good question. I know when we spoke with your foreign minister, Gabriel, I recall this in the spring, sitting in a meeting with him, they had a conversation, he and the secretary did, about that hostel in Berlin, if I recall. I think it was Berlin, is that correct? Yeah. Where I believe it was your government brought that to our attention. Again, I'm going back just by memory, but I recall they brought that to our attention and said, you know, we have all these North Korean guest workers working here, and these people are not keeping their own money. It's going back to North Korea. So in that instance, we found the government of Germany to be helpful in this. We recognize, and I think many of your nations do as well, that North Korea is tormenting not just the region, but the entire world. And they threaten not just the region, but the entire world. So we would continue to ask Germany or other countries around the world to recall those ambassadors, shrink the footprint of the size of entity that North Korea has in any given country. So that's a campaign. We continue to have those conversations with many nations.
A couple more on North Korea. Still on DPRK. Ma'am?
Thank you.
Hi.
Jessica Galato with the Yomiuri Shimbun Japanese newspaper. Do you have any updates on Ambassador Yoon's meetings with his South Korean counterpart?
So Ambassador Yoon met with his South Korean counterpart yesterday. Unfortunately, I don't have a readout of that meeting. You know, he has many conversations, a lot of various diplomatic dialogues with his counterparts overseas. I just don't have anything new for you on that. However, I would have to imagine that that meeting covered the topic of the day, and that is North Korea's belligerent actions.
It's on North Korea?
Yeah, one more on North Korea.
Yeah.
So we've mentioned the maximum pressure campaign, but I'm Aaron Mazler with Fuji TV.
Hi, Aaron.
So we're talking about the maximum pressure campaign, but China is the major supporter of North Korea. Do we have a plan on what we want to do with China? We just introduced new sanctions. There has been information in the past that China has been spotty with enforcing their sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
There's been data from Reuters that we've seen a significant decrease in trade recently involving China. Trump announced today he's talked to President Xi about new sanctions. What is our plan in regards to China and cooperating with them?
Yeah, our plan continues. And we say this to China, and we say it to other countries as well, Russia would be one that would be included in that. China, I want to remind you, was one of the UN Security Council resolution backers the last two times that passed unanimously. So with China, with Russia, with other countries, we would say, go ahead and continue implementing, as they say they are, all the UN Security Council resolutions. Implement those fully and enforce them. That is something that we expect nations that sign on to that, that vote for the UN Security Council resolutions, will go ahead and do. So that would be the first thing. China has unique leverage with North Korea. We recognize that through trade. Russia is also another country that has some unique leverage with China. So we encourage China to use that leverage. We have a good dialogue with China. As many of you know, we had the four dialogues with China this year, and that culminated in the final meeting where the president and the secretary went to Beijing. So like with other countries, we recognize that China can do more. Many countries can do more. But China recognizes, we believe, the threat that North Korea poses. We believe they do. They have said to us in the past that they share our commitment to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, and we expect that they will adhere to that and follow through.
Okay, new topic.
Okay.
Or do you want to do one more?
We can do one more on DPRK.
One more on DPRK.
Okay.
Hi, Chen Liu from China Xinhua News Agency. Well, since the denuclearization is the final goal for all of the parties, so won't the U.S. think that the suspension, the two suspension theory or the policies that China raised could be a possible way to solve this problem?
I'm sorry, the two what?
Suspensions, like
freeze for freeze.
The freeze for freeze.
Got it.
Policy could just solve the problem, like the U.S. could consider next month just to stop the military drill with the South Korea.
I know that some countries like to bring up this idea that a freeze for freeze might actually work, that might give Kim Jong-un the shove that he needs to denuclearize, right? People ask that question. There is no, and I want to be very clear about this, there is absolutely no equivalency between the activities, the legal activities that the United States and the Republic of Korea's alliance has. We have a lawful, long-standing, defense-oriented military exercise that takes place. This contrasts that to what the DPRK is doing. What they are doing is unlawful. They're unlawful nuclear and ballistic missile programs that the world is against. When we do our freedom of navigation operations, when we do military exercises with our allies, we do these around the world. We don't just do this in that neighborhood. We do this around the world. They're legal, they're lawful, they're carried out in the spirit of the October 1st, 1953 U.S.-South Korean Mutual Defense Treaty. They're not only carefully monitored by the Neutral Nation Supervisory Commission, but they ensure full compliance with the Armistice Agreement.
Can I have to follow up on this one?
Yeah, sure.
Hi. Philippe Gelly with Le Figaro, France. How do you start a meaningful dialogue without first having a freeze for freeze?
Oh, goodness. Look, North Korea, pardon me, is showing no interest in sitting down and having conversations with the world at this point. When they shoot off ballistic weapons, when they do advanced nuclear tests, they are not indicating that they are serious about denuclearization. This is not just the United States calling for this. This is the entire world calling for this.
Switch topic.
Okay.
Rina.
Hi. Hi, I'm Reena Bhardwaj from CNN News 18 India. I also represent ANI.
Hi.
Just a quick question on North Korea. When Secretary Tillerson was in India, Sushma Swaraj did say that the diplomatic channels with North Korea would continue. The embassy would be there. Would you also consider talking to India all over again? And my second question is, of course, on GES.
Let me address your first one before I get to the second one. We have a wonderful relationship with Prime Minister Modi and the government of India. A part of our constant conversations with those nations is do more to help with North Korea. Do more to help. It is a global problem. It is a global threat. We hope that India will do more, and we'll continue to have those conversations with the government. Go ahead. You have GES.
Ivanka Trump is, of course, in India. Her visit to India, how do you gauge that? Is it beyond expectations? Do you think it was successful, a visit to India?
First, I want to say I'm so proud that the United States and India held the Global Entrepreneurship Summit in Hyderabad. We are also proud that Ivanka Trump, the president's not only his daughter, but also one of his trusted closest advisors, led the U.S. delegation over there. I can personally think of no better representative of a woman entrepreneur in the United States than her to go over there. She was invited personally by the Prime Minister to spearhead our delegation. The State Department, as some of you may know, was very involved in helping to facilitate all of this. We have a bunch of people on the ground there. I think it is a tremendous success when we bring in 1,500 entrepreneurs from around the world. Our embassies helped nominate, if I have that, if I understand that correctly, many of the entrepreneurs from around the world, picking entrepreneurs, saying, you know, we would like to help you get to India to be able to talk about the great work that you're doing, the jobs that you are growing. Part of the theory behind that is a women's empowerment and getting more women into the workforce, but helping them succeed in growing companies, finding investors for those companies. So we're very pleased with it that we brought in 1,500. More than half of those are women.
Still on GES? Anyone on GES?
Anything else on India?
GES.
Okay. Okay. No, nothing on India. Okay. Go ahead.
China.
Okay.
All right.
I thought we finished. We finished with Asia already.
Take Syria.
Okay. Let's go to Syria.
Jafar Al-Jafar here with Al-Mayadeen.
Yeah. Hi, sir. It's nice to see you again.
Good to see you, too. The status of the U.S. forces in Syria is somewhat murky. There's no legal basis for those forces, at least from the international law of the United Nations, and the government of Syria has called...
Sir, I'm afraid I'm going to have to stop you there, because I can only speak on behalf of the State Department, well, and Department of Defense would handle all of those issues, so I'm not authorized to speak about
my question is
true presence.
Concerning a statement Deputy Assistant Secretary of State John Polashek made on October the 26th in this town. When she was asked about the status of U.S. forces, she said that they would be withdrawing from Syria once ISIS was defeated.
Mm.
Now that ISIS has been defeated, is there a timeline? And what is the timeline for U.S. forces?
Okay. I can't give you a timeline for U.S. forces. Again, that would be a Department of Defense decision and all of that. I can tell you why we're in Syria, why the United States and the 73 members of the de-ISIS coalition, that, by the way, includes nations, but also international organizations such as NATO and others. We are in Syria to defeat ISIS. For no other reason. We have seen, sir, I imagine you've seen, are you from Syria?
No.
Palestine. From Palestine. Okay. Many of us have seen the horrible things that have happened in Syria as a result of Bashar al-Assad, as a result of ISIS. The United States wants to stop that. The global coalition wants to stop that. While Raqqa fell, and that was significant, we still have a lot of work to do. The United States has given a lot of money. We have people there on the ground who are engaged in demining activities. We've seen the booby traps that have been set by ISIS. We've seen what they've done to schools, what they've done to homes, what they've done to families and children, and the killing still continues. So the United States hopes to facilitate the Geneva talks. That is something that is important. We remain committed to that. We believe that the ultimately, what happens will be a political resolution in Syria, that the Syrians, when they're able to decide, will be able to decide that on their own. But we're a long way off from that. The reason we are in Syria, though, is to defeat ISIS. Okay. Anything else on Syria?
Sorry, Syria.
Okay.
Syria?
Pardon me.
China.
Okay.
I have a question about China. Thank you. I'm Shirley from China Central Television. So as we know, it's nearly at the end of the year. And when we look back, we can see the bilateral meeting between Chinese President Xi Jinping and President Trump in Mar-a-Lago, the meeting in April, and also Trump's visit to China in November.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you evaluate China relations this year especially? And what impressed you most among all these kind of dialogues you mentioned and meetings? Thank you.
Okay. Well, let me start by saying we had the series of four comprehensive dialogues, which is something that the President Trump had had outlined with President Xi at Mar-a-Lago, I believe it was in April or May of earlier this year, we had four of those dialogues that had taken place in Florida, in China, in the United States, and all of that, which is pretty significant considering how long it takes to get to China and to the United States. We have a strong relationship with China. It is a results-oriented relationship. It's a constructive bilateral relationship. We've had areas of cooperation, but also areas of tension, as we do with other countries. We will continue to work with the government of China to address trade imbalances, the threats to the United States and regional security, also the global challenges, including the threat of terrorism. I want to make something clear that when we disagree with nations such as China, we raise those concerns consistently in a forthright fashion and forcefully, whether or not it's on trade, security issues, South China Sea, or the matter of human rights. So I'd say we have a strong relationship with the government of China. I know that the president and the first lady and Secretary Tillerson had a very nice trip there, and I know they look forward to it, and we look forward to working with the government. Okay. Yes. Hi.
Let's do.
Yes.
Ethiopia, please.
Go ahead. Let's just one more. Let's do another China, and then we'll get over. Okay. Okay. Ma'am, sorry.
Hi, Nadia Chow, Washington correspondent for Liberty Times Taiwan. On human rights dialogue, can you update us, you know, in the past years, what's the major topic between UN and China on human rights? In the past, you know, you may urge China to release some prominent dissidents, but what Trump administration has accomplished so far? And the follow-up question is, the NGO worker from Taiwan has been sentenced to 5 years by Chinese government for the subversion of the nation. I wonder if you have any, you know, response to this case, and has ever, you know, U.S. talked with the Chinese on this specific case? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Tell me the name of the person you mentioned.
Li Mingzhe.
Li Mingzhe, yes. So he's been sentenced to 5 years in prison on what we consider to be vague charges of subversion of power. We are urging the Chinese authorities to release Mr. Li and allow him to return to his family. And that's all I have for you on that case.
About the U.S. and China, human rights.
Yeah. I mean, human rights is a core American value and a core right that we believe people all around the world possess. That is something that we continue to have conversations with the government of China and many other nations as well, where there are human rights issues. In terms of the specifics, a lot of those are private diplomatic conversations. There are some nations where we will not call them out publicly on some of these things because we believe that we can be the most effective behind the scenes. So I don't have anything for you that I can provide you in terms of specifics because that would be a private diplomatic conversation, but I can assure you that the president, the vice president, and also Secretary Tillerson, consistently have those conversations with China.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.